Two stories about Jesus and his disciples on the Sea of Galilee. That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A fierce squall came up and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the winds died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him."
Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. After leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray. Later that night, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. Shortly before dawn, he went out to them, walking on the lake. He was about to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out because they all saw him and were terrified. Immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take courage, it is I. Don't be afraid." Then he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened.
Hello again. My name is Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here at Cedar Ridge, and we're in a series at the moment called Stories of Comfort and Hope. And today we're going to look at those two stories that we just heard read to us, both stories set on the Sea of Galilee, which was in Jesus's home area. One is Jesus calming the storm, one is Jesus walking on water. And that latter term, walking on water, has become synonymous, I think, with magical powers or heroics. I think we'll see in this story it means something other than that. But storms themselves, I think, are a great metaphor for us because they represent things that are beyond our control. And we all experience that. Collectively, right now, we're in a pandemic which can feel out of control. But there's many other things going on in our lives privately that can feel that way too. And even publicly, we're not just in a pandemic. We have all the ongoing challenges and difficulties and stormy situations in the world. We've just been praying for George Floyd and racial injustice in our nation and around the world. We've had shootings in Kabul again in a maternity unit of all places. We've had earthquakes recently and tragedies like planes in Pakistan crashing and killing dozens of people. So we have situations that are tragic, that seem out of control and beyond our control. So we're going to look at these stories in light of that. We've looked at these stories before, but I think that it's timely to look at them again. And let me share why I think that's the case. There's one way of looking at this story. It's a traditional way of looking at it, I think, really, which is that the story shows how Jesus is God. And as God, Jesus saves his disciples from calamitous situations and rescues them. And that's certainly one way of looking at this story. But I think there's another way of looking at it too. Let me explain why I think we need to look for another meaning. Firstly, that sense of always being rescued by God is not our experience in life. Our problems don't always go away. We don't always come through them the way we hope. Sometimes we do. But very often that's not the case. No matter how much we pray, no matter how much we hope, no matter how much we wish that were the case. So that's not our experience. I think in the text also, we have more than that to the story. Jesus seems somewhat annoyed at his disciples for their lack of faith. In that first story with the storm, he's somewhat annoyed at being woken up, as if he expected more of the disciples, that there's more to this than just rescue me, in other words. So we're going to explore some of those alternative meanings. I think a key issue here is expectations. We'll talk in a moment about Jesus's expectations of the disciples, but clearly the disciples here have an expectation that they're going to get rescued. They have expectations of God, in other words. And whenever we get our expectations wrong, we're prone to disappointment and discouragement. If you think about it, humanity, since it's for the first time we had a conscious sense of reality, we've been trying to figure things out, and we've ascribed all kinds of things to God or to gods. We've had expectations that we would get judged or punished for certain actions. We've had expectations that we would get rewarded for other good actions. We've tried to placate gods or placate God through religious practice and that kind of thing, with an expectation that we'll get something in return. And I think that's changed and evolved over the years. And maybe even our expectations now need to change and evolve somewhat. If we're thinking about God and relating to God as one who solves our problems, we might be likely to be disappointed and discouraged. And that can then lead to resentment. It can lead to confusion, insecurity, and fear, and many of the things that we often experience in our faith. So I think this is going to be relevant for us and important for us to look for more meaning in the story together. So let's jump into these stories. We just heard them read to us. They're set on the Sea of Galilee, as I mentioned. Here's a map to sort of show the location of that. It was in the northern part of Palestine, a sort of key geographical landmark in Jesus's time. You'll see that on the eastern side of the lake is an area called the Decapolis. And that's significant. We'll get into this later in the story. It's an area in the east where there weren't many Jewish people. Most of the Jewish people lived on the western side of the lake. The Decapolis and some of the other areas were colonized by Hellenistic people, people influenced by Greek culture, and it was controlled and influenced by the Romans. They built 10 cities in that area. That's why it's called the Decapolis. And they would have been very pagan cities, very different cities and very different culture to the western side of the lake. So in that first story, when the disciples are heading out across the lake to the east, we need to bear that in mind. They're heading into the unknown, they're heading into foreign territory. That's going to be important as we unpack this story a little bit. Here's a more detailed map. If you look around the coast of the lake, you'll see that there's familiar names probably there, like Capernaum, you know, familiar names from the Bible, stories about Jesus. Again, this is Jesus's home area of Galilee. It's about 8 miles wide and about 12 miles long. So it's a big lake, and it gets up to 200 feet in depth in parts. And you'll see that, you know, it's a beautiful lake. I mean, here's a picture of the lake today. Very beautiful, but it could also be treacherous. Here's another picture of storm clouds gathering in the present day. The reason for that was that it's considerably below sea level. And so you would have winds, cold winds coming in from the east side of the lake. Again, you know, maybe there's some metaphor in that as well, but that's literally what happens too. Cold winds would come from the east, and they'd go over the lake and meet and collide with the warm moisture from the lake and result in quite tumultuous storms and rapidly developing storms. So this storm that we read about in the first story was probably not that unusual. The people in the boat, apart from Jesus, the people in the boat, many of them would have been fishermen and familiar with a storm like this. Let's think a little bit about the boat that they were in. We don't really know exactly what that was like, but we have an idea of what fishing boats were like in that day. Back in 1986, this boat was excavated from the shore of Lake Galilee, from the western shore. It's become known as the Ancient Galilee Boat or even the Jesus Boat, although there's no evidence that it was associated with Jesus. But scholars do believe it dates from the first century, so from around that time. And that boat is about 27 feet long, about 7.5 feet wide. So, you know, substantial boat, but a small boat to be in a storm. And I think we can probably relate to the kind of danger that they were in. Here's a depiction, an artistic depiction of what that boat might have looked like back then. And then, of course, there's been all kinds of artistic depictions of this particular story. Here's a famous painting from Rembrandt. You'll see here, if you can see some of the detail, you'll see Jesus asleep in the stern, somewhat panicked disciples. There's even one vomiting over the side of the boat. So this is a more perhaps fantastical representation of that storm. But I think we can imagine, even in the present day, being in a small boat in a storm like this would be pretty scary, even if you're an experienced sailor, an experienced fisherman, as many of Jesus' disciples were. So as we dig into this first story, there's lots of emotion in the story. The disciples are very afraid, and their fear in some ways mirrors the physical storm. They're afraid of that they're going to die. And I think we have to face the fact that this must have been a really bad storm, because they would have been used to being out on the sea. They're also afraid of Jesus. They say at the end of the story, who is this? He kind of freaks them out. And they're also, I think, annoyed at Jesus. They're thinking, really, you know, Jesus, don't you care if we drown? I mean, what are you doing asleep in the boat? And there's something somewhat that's crazy about Jesus being asleep in the boat. You imagine that, a small boat like that, in the kind of storm that they're in. Jesus is probably being swamped with waves himself, as well as being, you know, moving up and down with the waves. It's hard to believe that anybody could be asleep in that situation. Perhaps that means we should take this somewhat metaphorically. It doesn't mean it didn't happen, but the fact that Jesus is still asleep there is perhaps alluding to something more than just the literal meaning. As we explore some of that metaphorical meaning of the story as a whole, I think we'll see that come out. Jesus himself is quite emotional. He seems actually kind of annoyed with the disciples. That's perhaps the big surprise. And at first reading, in one sense, this story isn't all that comforting, because Jesus, A, is asleep and doesn't seem all that bothered. And B, when he does wake up, is kind of, he reprimands them, he rebukes them. His rebuke to the wind and the waves of peace be still is not 100% clear whether he's not also implying the same thing for the disciples, peace be still. And he's for instance, says they have not just little faith, but no faith. So it's kind of harsh, feels a little harsh at that point, because I think you and I can probably relate to being afraid and in need and hoping for some kind of rescue, especially with someone like Jesus in the boat. Let's explore the metaphorical meaning a little bit more, though, here of the storm. The seas in Hebrew culture were representative of disorder, chaos, evil, even. And we see that time and time again in the ancient Hebrew stories. Let me just quote one psalm to you. This is in Psalm 89. It says, "Who is like you, Lord God Almighty? You, Lord, are mighty and faithful. You, Lord, are mighty, and your faithfulness surrounds you. You rule over the surging sea when its waves mount up. You still them. You crushed Rahab like one of the slain. With your strong arm, you scattered your enemies." That term Rahab is representative of the ancient sea monster, the kind of depiction, if you like, of the chaos and evil of the ocean. We might not see the ocean that way, especially if we're used to going to the ocean to bathe and have fun, you know, on vacation. But people who are out on the high seas experience the terror of the oceans. And people who are not used to the ocean, such as the Hebrew people who grew up in barren, dry areas, where water and bodies of water were often represented difficulty to them, maybe flooding and danger. They saw this as disorder and chaos and not good. But God overcame those storms. And that term Rahab also means, it was a term representative of Egypt. And so, you know, Egypt represents enslavement for the Hebrew people and oppression from foreign powers. So the sea is not just representative of chaos and disorder and evil in general, but very specifically related to oppression. And that part is where this issue of where they're going is so significant. They're crossing the lake to the eastern side, to the Decapolis. They're going into foreign territory, unknown territory. They're going into an area run and controlled and culturalized, if that's a word, by the Roman Empire. And remember, they are under Roman domination. So they're going into like an epicenter, if you like, of political oppression. That's important in this story. And I think we have to remember that Mark, the writer of Mark, wrote this gospel at a time when most scholars would say the early church, the first Christians, were under an awful oppression from the Roman Empire during the reign of Nero. And you can imagine that this sense of being in a storm would have been very real to the people reading it for the first time. In the story, we have God in the storm. The story seems to be based on and certainly told with another psalm in mind, and that's Psalm 107. Let me read you an excerpt from that psalm, and I think you'll see how it kind of correlates with this story. Some went out on the sea in ships. This is reading from verse 23. They were merchants on the mighty waters. They saw the works of the Lord, his wonderful deeds in the deep. For he spoke and stirred up a tempest that lifted high the waves. They mounted up to the heavens and went down to the depths. In their peril, their courage melted away. They reeled and staggered like drunkards, and they were at their wits' end. Then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the sea were hushed. So I think you could see the correlation with this story. And here we have, I think, a suggestion then that Jesus is being depicted as God in the story we just read in Mark chapter 4. Jesus is the one doing the calming. So there's a sense of the divine in Jesus that is being displayed and perhaps revealed and manifest in a way that it hasn't quite before. Certainly that seems to be the case for the disciples as they experience it, and they're afraid, you know, they're in awe of it. Now Jesus is, we'll come back to that in a moment, the divine in this story. But Jesus, as the divine one, is asleep in the story. And it, you know, as we said, that's kind of bizarre in some respects. I mean, perhaps it represents a model for us that, you know, we should be centered and calm and at peace no matter what's going on around us. But it's still a little unusual. Perhaps it also represents our sense that God sometimes feels absent. I mean, I think this is what is at the heart of the disciples' anguish. Don't you care if we drown? It's like Jesus should be helping out. Jesus should be helping these, even just physically and practically, helping bail out the boat. And if he has additional powers, rescuing them. And he seems reluctant to do that. And I think we can all relate to that too. Very often we feel, especially when we're in difficult times, it can feel like God is absent. God doesn't care about us. God's forgotten about us. We can feel abandoned. Imagine too how the first readers of this story, back in the first century when they're being persecuted terribly by the Roman Empire, how they must have felt. There must have been a sense of abandonment. What's going on here? And this story will, as we'll see, perhaps bring some comfort to them and to us, but in ways that we might not necessarily be expecting. As we said, Jesus seems annoyed to be woken up. So this divine figure is not like waking up and all apologetic about, oh, I'm sorry, gosh, I didn't mean to fall asleep. I know I'd have been like that. You think of times when you've overslept you've perhaps got home late and you've not been able to help with things that you should have been helping out with. Our natural tendency there is to be apologetic and sorry about that. What can I do? How can I help out? There's none of that here from Jesus. Jesus is like, why did you wake me up? And somewhat annoyed. And so I think what that's saying to us is that Jesus is expecting more of them than we might think. Jesus says you have no faith. So if they had faith, what would have been the outcome? Suppose they had enough faith not to wake Jesus up. The implication is that they could have got through this themselves, and that they could have persevered and got through the storm. But perhaps it means that they would have should have trusted more. Maybe they could have calmed the storm themselves. I mean, who knows? But But there's certainly an expectation on Jesus' part that they didn't necessarily need rescuing by him. And I think this is a kind of a hard piece for us, because there's something in us that desperately wants to be rescued and desperately brought out of our problems and have all those problems solved. But I think the issue here is, here's the divine one, Jesus. Now, we've talked about Jesus before as being, we could just think of Jesus as, well, Jesus is God, kind of disguised as a human being, but with these superpowers. And Jesus's role in the story then is to rescue these human beings who do not have superpowers and need rescuing and need helping out. Another way of looking at Jesus's divinity is that Jesus is a human being who is divine at the same time, because he is so full of the divine essence, so full of God's presence, so full of God's spirit. And not only that, he invites us into that same experience. Jesus invites us into the experience of the Christ, if you like. And we're not just to sort of sit back and wait to be rescued, but we're to enter into that. We're to be empowered by the Spirit of God, by the presence of God. We're not victims. We have unfathomable potential. We're not necessarily waiting to be rescued. We're waiting to be empowered. For Jesus, salvation seems a lot more about empowerment than it does about rescue. We'll come back to that in a second, but I think that's an important and difficult implication for us in this story if we're looking at the some deeper meaning here. Now let's switch gears to the other story. We read a story that appears in Mark later on, a few chapters later, chapter 6, where Jesus walks on water. It's another strange story in some respect. It's not really a storm in this case. It just says that the disciples are rowing across the lake. They're actually headed to Bethsaida in the north. Jesus has gone off to pray, and he says, like, you know, he's actually just, this immediately follows the story of the feeding of the 5,000. And Jesus says, look, you know, you go ahead to where we're headed next. Go in the boat. I'll go to pray. And they're struggling. They're straining. The wind's against them. There's not a sense in this one, I think, that they think they're going to perish, but they're kind of in trouble. But the freaky thing about this story is that Jesus appears walking on the water, and they think it's a ghost. Again, Jesus is being depicted here as divine. Let me give you a couple of clues to that. When Jesus says, "Take courage, it is I," the Greek there for "it is I" is ego eimi. It means "I am." It's phrased in the English, "It is I." But really, it should be translated "I am." It's like, take courage, I am. And of course, that term "I am," as we've seen so often when it's used by Jesus, is really a reference, or it's certainly when the writers use that term about Jesus, it's a reference to the divinity of Jesus. It's equating Jesus with the name that was the sort of self-description for God used in used to Moses in Exodus. And you can read about that in chapter 3, where God says, "I am," in a sort of self-defining way. That's the name of God. And that term means to exist, to be, to happen, to be present. It's a very difficult term to translate. But that's sort of being itself, if you like. And Jesus is equated with that. There's another more subtle reference to the divinity of Jesus here, I think, in that the writer says that Jesus went to pass by the boat. It's almost like he didn't notice them, which, you know, of course he would notice them. The issue here, I think, is that the writer is alluding to a story in Exodus chapter 33, where God says to Moses, "Look, I'm going to pass by you, but you can't see my face, because anybody who sees my face will die. So you're going to have to hide in this cleft in the rock, and then I'll pass you by." And so God just sees the backside of God rather than the face of God. That term "pass by" is closely associated with deity. So Jesus, again, is this divine figure in this story. What I'd like to do at the moment is just read this story in Matthew's version. So Matthew has both of these stories, and we'll read this one in Matthew, because Matthew adds a piece in, the writer of Matthew adds a piece in, which I think is, again, significant for us as we think about our own lives. So in Matthew 14, it says, "Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. 'It's a ghost,' they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, 'Take courage, "It is I. Don't be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and began to sink and cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You have little faith," he said. "Why did you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." So here we have it's a lot more explicit. They worship him at the end of the story and ascribe him the name Son of God. Matthew's telling is a little different. It's different also in that it includes this story of Peter walking on the water. I think very often this part of the story is viewed as Peter's failure. In fact, you know, when you think about the authors here or the writing here, Mark's gospel is, scholars tend to think Peter's eyewitness account is very influenced or present in Mark's gospel. Mark was influenced, the writer of Mark was influenced by Peter. And it may be that Peter deliberately left out this part of the story. Some would say that. And it could be because he thought, "I don't want that in there because like I sank, basically. I mean, it's a bit, I look pretty lame." And whereas I would be thinking like this, if I saw somebody get out of the boat and just take four or five or two or three steps walking on the water, I'd be like, "Struth, that guy walked on water. I mean, that's a miracle. That's incredible." So this isn't about failure, I don't think. It's about courage and intentionality, and yet there's sort of a rebuke in it as well, because Jesus says, "Why do you have such little faith?" But let's also remember that in that rebuke, in this statement of little faith, and it's a little more positive than what we heard earlier, which was no faith, right? We've got to bear that in mind. But in this rebuke, there's also expectation on Jesus' part, because Jesus says, come to Peter. He's saying, he says to the disciples, take courage. But he's saying to Peter specifically, come. He has an expectation that Peter can do this. You can walk on the water. Peter doesn't, he walks a few steps, but doesn't make it all the way. And Jesus is still there for him. It's like there's compassion in this too, because Jesus isn't like, "Oh, you're a failure, you can just drown," but reaches out, grabs him, and they get into the boat. So there's this sense of expectation, but it not always working out. Like we can do things, we have potential to do things, we have potential to be empowered, but we don't always get there. And yet when we don't get there, God is still with us. There's still this presence of God depicted by Jesus in this story. So let's think about some applications for this story. I think there's many ways we can draw some comfort and hope from this story. I think it's very challenging at the same time, but I think in these challenges we can find comfort and hope. The first one is this: Jesus is inviting us to share in the divine life. We all have problems, we all have difficulties, and some of them are terrible. And we might be going through those right now. Again, some of those may be very public, we're all going through them. Some of them might be very private, represent our own private pain. We're all going through stuff. And I think there's a tendency in all of us to want God to take them away. We see God's function in the world is to intervene and help us out. And in this instance, though, that's I think Jesus, we've got to recognize that Jesus is expecting something else. Okay, there's for sure the waves and wind get calmed. Jesus walks on water. But there's embedded in the story an expectation that we will rise up to that same level. Jesus invites us into that divine life. That seems to be what Jesus was hoping for, if you think about hope and comfort from Jesus's point of view. So rather perhaps than wanting or seeking God to take our problems away, perhaps we should look for ways in which we can be empowered even in our difficult situations. When storms come, maybe we have the power to calm them. I think of that in terms of my own life and how easy it is for me in difficult circumstances. Maybe when people do things to me or I make mistakes or situations just get out of control. I can stir myself up into a frenzy of anxiety and insecurity and self-defense. And it's not good. It's a bad storm. It's a chaotic storm. It's an oppressive storm. But on the other hand, I can also bring peace to that storm. I can center myself. And that's why we emphasize so often here the importance of contemplative practice, of meditation, prayer, centering exercises, letting go exercises, that can really help us to calm ourselves in the storm, no matter what's going on. And in that sense, perhaps Jesus really is the model here, asleep in the boat. It's a somewhat extreme model. It's a hyperbolic model, but it's a model of no matter what's going on around us, being at peace and being calm. Secondly, we can walk on water. Now, again, an expectation of Jesus. I don't know whether I would really necessarily want that power, superpower, if you want to call it. If Jesus said, okay, you know, I'll give you one thing here, you know, what would it be? I'm not sure that walking on water would be top of the list. So, you know, we're not going to be, I don't think we all want to literally walk on water. So this is metaphorical. It has to be. We, as I said earlier, Jesus, most of the time, traveled by boat. He did not walk on water out of habit. So, walking on water literally is not the issue. The issue is here, I think, or the meaning here is that joining in the divine life with Jesus means that we are able to do things that we might think are impossible or that seem impossible. That's what sharing in the divine life is all about. What does that look like? It means being courageous to even step out of the boat. Again, coming back to Peter didn't fail because of sinking. Peter succeeded because he got out of the boat. What does it look like for us? Well, I think it looks like persevering. It may be as simple as persevering through hardship, through difficulties, being faithful, remaining calm, remaining centered, working at that. I mean, it might feel like it's impossible, but that's walking on water. Again, what we're going through at the moment with the pandemic can feel like it's pressing in on all sides of us. It's disrupting things. It's causing chaos. It can create a sense of hopelessness. Or we can, despite that, find a center, find peace, and persevere through. The same for all the personal storms that we're going through. I think it also means getting out of the boat and doing things that seem impossible, like loving people who seem unlovable, allowing ourselves to be loved, being vulnerable, forgiving the unforgivable. It means sharing what we have, taking the risk of sharing what we have and not worrying that we might lose out. A lot of the things that we looked at in the Sermon on the Mount when we looked at Jesus's teachings there, things that are really hard. But that we're going to practice. And I think that's the key here, that we do these things by stepping out of the boat, by walking. Walking on water is practiced. It's, you have to get out of the boat. You have to take the risk of loving, of forgiving, of sharing, of caring, of being vulnerable. We can't just pray for it to happen. We can't expect it to happen magically. This happens by being courageous and taking the risk. I think it also represents the direction in which they're going in the first story. Perhaps this is sort of mixing the two stories up because Jesus only walks on water in the second story. But I think you'll bear with me on this one. They're heading towards foreign territory. They're heading towards a center of oppression. I think walking on water is saying, like, no matter how intimidated we feel, no matter how overwhelming it may seem, we're still going to struggle against injustice. We're going to take a stand on things. We're going to keep fighting racial injustice in our own lives and in our nation as a whole. It's so easy to give up. It would be so easy to stay in the boat. And I think there's another interesting metaphor actually in that first story. It says right at the beginning of the story, almost a throwaway comment, there were other boats with them. They don't get referenced again in the story, but I think that just right now reminds me of the fact that we're all in a storm. And we're all in the same storm in terms of the pandemic, but we're all in very different boats. And some of our boats are quite secure and buffered, and you know, it's easier for us to weather this storm. There are other communities in our culture that are less buffered, where there's endemic poverty, and where they're much more vulnerable. And we need to get out of the boat. We don't need to just sit in our boat in our self-protected area. We need to get out of the boat and walk on water and struggle for justice and never give up. It's tiring. It's hard work. It can feel oppressive itself because we're taking on such big issues. But that, to me, is what walking on water means. Thirdly and finally, imperfection is not failure. Again, we come back to good old Peter. And I mean, what a guy. He gets out the boat, he sinks, but he walks on water, and we've got to hand that to him. Now, you could look at the whole thing as he sunk in the end. But you know, that's not failure. The real failure would have been not getting out of the boat in the first place. So we experience that all the time, don't we? I think we experience the paradox of the divine life in many respects, and that is that there are times, and you might, maybe it feels a little awkward to think of ourselves as being like Jesus or being invited to that same kind of life. We might almost feel like that, you know, we could be nothing like Jesus. So to experience the divine life in the way that Jesus does might feel awkward. But let's think about this practically. I think in everyday life, there are times when we feel almost like supercharged with God, right? We feel confident, we feel full of love and hope and perhaps comfort. We feel like we're in the zone, and we have a deep sense that God is with us, in us and around us. There are times like that we all experience. There are other times when we feel God to be absent, and we don't feel like we're participating in the divine life, and it feels hard and difficult. We experience both. I think the point here is God is with us in both of those situations. And God is with us in the storm. God is with us in the at the mountaintop experience. God is with us, and these stories tell us that. And the point here, I think, is don't give up. We don't get it right all the time. We're struggling. We're on a journey, and we may walk one or two steps, and then we stumble or sink. The point is not to see that as failure, but as actually that's what practice is. We keep walking. We keep taking these steps. That's how we grow. That's how we participate in the divine life of Jesus. That's how we engage with it. We're actually on at a time of the year, right today, in fact, is Pentecost Sunday. It's a time when we celebrate the coming of the Holy Spirit. I mean, I don't think when we read the biblical account, we have any reason to believe that the God's Spirit was ever absent, but there was a sort of perception of it being absent, and there's this celebration of the fullness of God's Spirit being present with humanity on the day of Pentecost. And I want to read a final scripture for us from John's Gospel that I think mirrors what Jesus was saying when he said, "Take courage," to his disciples in the story we just read. And that captures the essence, I think, of Pentecost, of God's Spirit being with us. Here's what it says in John's Gospel, chapter 14. "I will not leave you as orphans," this is Jesus speaking. "I will come to you. Before long, the world will not see me anymore, but you will see me. Because I live, you also will live. On that day, you will realize that I am in my Father, and you are in me, and I am in you. All this I have spoken while still with you. But the Advocate, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, will teach you all things and will remind you of everything I said to you. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give you. I do not give you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled and do not be afraid." So those are incredibly comforting words. Comforting words that I think if we felt that we're abandoned might seem fake and phony. Comforting words that I think if we see God's role as solving all our problems and delivering us from all our difficult situations would feel fake and phony, but they don't feel fake and phony. They feel full of comfort and hope when we see God as being present in our storm, being present in our difficulties. So I hope that's a source of comfort to you, a source of hope. I think those things are all very challenging. I don't think it's like, let's just lie down and feel comfort. It's much more challenging than that, but perhaps we can wrestle with that and find it to be a source of hope and comfort. As we close out here, we're going to have communion together. So you might want to stop the video and for a second and go grab something to eat and drink. It could be bread and wine or juice and crackers, really anything. And we're going to celebrate God's presence with us. That's what communion is all about, remembering Jesus's presence with his disciples back in the stories that we read about, and also incredibly with us today. But before we take communion, we're just going to do a very short meditation together. And it's a meditation that we've done before, and it's based on Psalm 46. And there's a verse in Psalm 46 that's very famous. It says, "Be still and know that I am God." And we're going to meditate on this in such a way that it will hopefully center us, no matter what we're feeling or experiencing right now. And I think you'll as we meditate on it, it's just a very brief meditation. You'll see some and hear some echoes of the stories that we've just been reading about. So let's just sit very quietly, calm ourselves. I think it would help probably to close our eyes, or some relaxing images will appear on the screen that we could focus on. And sit with your back straight and your feet on the floor so that you're comfortable and not distracted. And we'll just take some deep breaths in and out to center ourselves. And then just focus on the words that I speak. I'll speak and then there'll be some silence. And I'll speak and there'll be some more silence. We'll just repeat that as we meditate on this very short verse from Psalm 46. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know Be still. Be. Amen.